From KCRW in Santa Monica and PRI, Public Radio International, this is To The Point.
Jeff Sessions, new sheriff in town. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To The Point. Violent crimes at an all-time low. President Trump's attorney general, though, says he wants to keep it that way by removing federal limits on local police. Critics fear Jeff Sessions is going back to the tough-on-crime days of mass incarceration of nonviolent drug offenders in American jails and prisons. But federal lawbreakers are just 10% of the nation's criminals, and even red states are cutting costs by reducing incarceration without increasing crime. Other states have legalized recreational marijuana. Is America facing a cultural crisis over another war on drugs? Later on today's Talking Point, tuition assistance for New York students makes college free, but not for everybody. First, here's the news.
Check out KCRW's All News Channel, News 24, programming from KCRW, NPR, BBC, and more, 24 hours a day. Go to kcrw.com/news24 or listen on KCRW's app.
Support for To The Point comes from the members of KCRW and from the Public Radio International Program Fund.
Hello again, Marvin Alney, back with To The Point. The pendulum swings between treatment-focused approaches to drug abuse and tough law enforcement. Now, after years of Obama-era reforms, President Trump's Attorney General Jeff Sessions wants local police freed from federal restrictions to fight another war on drugs. Today's Talking Point, Governor Andrew Cuomo announced tuition assistance for New York college students today with Hillary Clinton by his side. It's a step toward free education, but it's not all that's been advertised. First, this news update. In Moscow today, Secretary of State Rex Tillerson had a long private meeting with Vladimir Putin. Later, he met the press with Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov.
I expressed the view that the current state of U.S.-Russia relations is at a low point. There is a low level of trust between our two countries. The world's two foremost nuclear powers cannot have this kind of relationship.
David Filipov is Moscow bureau chief for The Washington Post. Thanks for joining us again from Moscow.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Apparently, President Putin kept Mr. Tillerson waiting for a long time.
Well, that's his game. I mean, he'll keep the Queen of England or the Queen of Denmark waiting. This whole mystery about whether they'd meet at all and, you know, making him wait is part of the Putin sort of plan. Tillerson is not a president, so he had to wait his turn.
So he said that he expressed problems between the two nuclear powers, two senior nuclear powers. What did Mr. Lavrov have to say?
Well, okay, so both sides, you know, have agreed to disagree on the big one. U.S. still says Bashar al-Assad has to go. They say that he was carried at the Syrian government forces he controlled, carried out the chemical weapons attack. Lavrov says, we don't believe it. We're not covering up for anyone, but we want an investigation, and we don't want to come in and do regime change. That's at the bottom of it. Now, after their meetings, there's no statement from Putin, but the two sides are talking about all the things they're going to do together. They're going to try to make sure North Korea doesn't become a nuclear power. They're going to set up a working group to try to find ways that the United States and Russia can solve their problems. There's this kind of willingness in their rhetoric to kind of get along with the ultimate goal, which is they disagree on Syria. That's not solved.
Willingness to get along, not exactly what we heard from Nikki Haley, the UN representative of the United States today, talking directly to her Russian counterpart.
You are isolating yourselves from the international community every time one of Assad's planes drop another barrel bomb on civilians, and every time Assad tries to starve another community to death. People not just in the West, but across the Middle East and the world are speaking out against Assad's brutality. It is long past time for Russia to stop covering for Assad.
So once again, David Filipov, does that sound consistent with what you heard today from Rex Tillerson?
Well, Rex Tillerson is not saying anything like that at the public press conference after, and it's still going on, but he's not sounding that way in this show in the Kremlin. And I say show because his whole public attitude has been sort of positive, we disagree, and that's what Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister, is doing as well. the battleground here was probably in that closed-door meeting with President Putin. What we're hearing in the United Nations is what, you know, the United States is projecting. Now, are we 100% convinced that all of the United States players are sounding the same note? That's been one of the problems in this whole thing over Syria, is that we're getting different signals from time to time. But Tillerson is not sounding that angry note at all.
Tillerson is a man once given a Medal of Friendship by Vladimir Putin.
Yeah, the Medal of Friendship. You know, I did a lot of research into that thing. He's known as a tough negotiator who fought tooth and nail for the right to do Exxon's deals the way he saw fit. The Order of Friendship is something that a lot of people got. You know, a former coach of the Cleveland Cavaliers got it. You know, a pianist got it. That doesn't mean that he was in the pocket of Putin, and it's clear that he carried the sort of hard line in. I think they're making a show here now of showing what they have in common to work with so that the world doesn't think it's all, you know, basically gone to hell after this meeting. What Nikki Haley is doing out there on the fringes so far of this conversation is showing that the U.S. position hasn't changed, if you ask me.
Apparently, the language in the Kremlin is argumentative, saying the Trump administration is primitive and inconsistent. I don't think Mr. Lavrov said that, but I take it that that's what others are saying.
Right. If you take the Nikki Haley part and the counterpoint of that, everybody in the Russian establishment today was throwing things out. Counterproductive. Don't bring your ultimatums to us. Childish, primitive. You don't know. You should learn history. You know, they went after Sean Spicer. I saw a 10-minute long report about, you know, Spicer's comments about the Holocaust Center, and they were just having at. That's where the rhetoric is. This sort of bulldog, two diplomats trying to work it out in their kind of calm tones. That's what they're showing on, you know, world television right now.
And a third bulldog that we didn't see on television, Vladimir Putin, who met with Tillerson behind closed doors.
And, you know, that's the most important thing here, because we know there's one person who makes decisions in Russia, and that's Vladimir Putin. And what Tillerson had to say, he said to Vladimir Putin, and he's going to bring that back to the Trump administration. We don't know exactly what that was, but we're getting the sense that there is at least an attempt here to bump the needle from the bottom, and we are on the bottom, to at least create something, working group, whatever you want to call it, some sort of agreement on something, because it can't get any worse than this.
David Filipov, extraordinary service to our listeners from Moscow during these situations, the conversations that are going on there. Many thanks to being on our program.
All right, thanks for having me.
Bureau Chief of the Washington Post. In a moment, Jeff Sessions, new sheriff in town, on To the Point from PRI.
KCRW thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com.
We're on Alney back with To the Point. As a senator, Alabama Republican Jeff Sessions got credit for killing a criminal justice reform bill, despite the support from arch-conservative senators, the Koch brothers, even the NAACP. It would have eased provisions left over from the war on drugs that had led to mass incarceration, especially of black Americans. Now, Sessions is Donald Trump's new attorney general, and he's hired one of the foremost soldiers in that war on drugs. That's according to Sari Horowitz, who covers the Justice Department for the Washington Post. Great to have you on our program. Thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
Who is this soldier in the war on drugs?
Steve Cook. Steve Cook was the former president of the National Association of Assistant U.S. Attorneys, and he spoke out a lot in the last couple of years against the movement to reform the criminal justice system, and no one really paid that much attention to him. He was so far on the fringes because, as you said, so many people, the Koch brothers, the NAACP, the Obama administration, Republican lawmakers, Democratic lawmakers, supported that movement. And he spoke out against it on behalf of federal prosecutors, and now he's a top lieutenant for the attorney general.
He is not on the fringe anymore. What does this mean, do you think, for policy by the U.S. Justice Department?
Well, Jeff Sessions, since he became the attorney general in February, he hasn't spoken out a lot about specific policy changes, but they're coming, because he has been giving speeches and writing memos to his prosecutors talking about the need to crack down on crime and crack down on drug use. Yesterday, he was on the southwest border in Nogales, Arizona, and he was talking about how he wanted his federal prosecutors, he was directing them, to make immigration cases a higher priority and look for opportunities to bring serious felony charges against those who cross the border illegally. So tough crack down on crime from the Attorney General.
He's also not supportive of the kind of police reforms we saw during the Obama administration, and particularly the consent decrees. Here's what he had to say, speaking to the International Association of Chiefs of Police just this week.
We're adding additional pressure on our police, and almost a sort of a demoralization of the very fabric of law enforcement and law and order, in a diminishment, a really an undermining of the respect we owe our law officers who walk these streets every day.
So, sorry, Horowitz, what does that mean for the consent decrees that are already in effect and those that are being negotiated?
It means they're in trouble, those consent decrees and those agreements that are still being negotiated. You know, what we're really seeing here are two different worldviews. The Obama administration was trying to use the Justice Department, use the federal government, to hold local police accountable and make sure that local police didn't violate the Constitution, use excessive force, or racially discriminate against people in their communities. The Sessions Justice Department is saying that they believe the federal government went too far and needs to pull back on this approach. And as you ran that excerpt of Jeff Sessions, he feels like the federal government needs to respect local police more, provide them with more moral support and more resources. So these consent decrees are really in trouble now. We saw this in Baltimore last week when the Justice Department tried to delay that consent decree. It was going before a judge, tried to delay a hearing, and the judge went ahead with it and is pushing ahead. But we know that the Justice Department is not really supportive of that consent decree. And the one in Chicago that was negotiated really in the waning days of the Obama administration may never see the light of day.
Now, Mr. Sessions has spoken of Chicago in particular to suggest that despite the fact that there's been a long-term decline in crime, it might in fact be going up. Here's what he said once again to the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
I don't think that the rising crime we've seen in violent crime in the last year or two is just a blip. I'm afraid we're facing a pretty serious thing.
Ed Chung is Vice President for Criminal Justice Reform at the Center for American Progress. That's a progressive public health policy research and advocacy organization. He was with the Department of Justice in the Civil Rights Division during the Obama administration. Ed Chung, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
What do you say to what we just heard from the current Attorney General about the rise in crime and the fact that it may not just be a blip?
Well, I think certainly there is a rise in crime in certain cities and communities across the country. For example, Chicago clearly in the last couple of years has experienced a dramatic increase in homicides and violent crime. But that does not necessarily mean that it is prevalent across the country in every single community. National crime rates there, if you aggregate it all together, there have been a total increase in violent crime and homicides. But there are, if you extrapolate from the data, you can see that cities such as Chicago or Milwaukee or Baltimore really are the drivers of those crimes. But then on the other hand, you've seen cities, large metropolitan areas, that have either a stable crime rate or a decreasing crime rate. New York City in 2016 hit historic lows both in violent crime and homicides. Washington, D.C., where I'm at right now, in 2015 had an increase in homicides, but also in 2016, a decrease in homicides. So painting the entire country with a broad brush that violent crime is on the rise, and the rhetoric that we've heard from the administration and also the Trump campaign about this American carnage, it's a little bit more nuanced than that, and policymakers should dig deep under the numbers before making broad policy judgments and decisions that affect the entire country.
Have the consent decrees that were put into effect while you were in the Civil Rights Division had an effect? Have they lowered crime?
Well, let's just take a look at what Chief Charlie Beck said for the consent decree that was entered into in Los Angeles. He praised the process. That was a long, arduous process. If you recall, that resulted from the Rampart Division's excessive use of force, tampering with evidence, and so forth. And when that consent decree was lifted after 12 years, sometime in 2013, because the department substantially complied with that consent decree. He said that the department is something that is now transformed into one that he's proud of, that he could hand off to his children, who are two of whom are police officers with the LAPD, and he had praise for it. And going back to what Sari said about Baltimore, the police commissioner there, when the Sessions Department of Justice was trying to pause or delay the implementation or the acceptance of that consent decree, Commissioner Kevin Davis came out and strongly supported it, saying that we need it and the community will come out stronger for it. And so there is definitely examples across the country that consent decrees have strengthened police departments and in turn strengthened community police relations and public safety.
Ed Chung again, formerly with the Obama Justice Department Civil Rights Division. Heather McDonald is a fellow at the Manhattan Institute. That's a conservative think tank. She's author of the book, Are Cops Racist? How the War Against the Police Harms Black Americans. Heather McDonald, welcome to you.
Well, thank you, Warren. I'm pleasure to be on.
Do you agree with Sari Horowitz that there are two worldviews about policing and crime that are represented now by first the Obama administration and Ed Chung, now by the Trump administration and yourself?
Yes, I agree. I think that we heard relentlessly from President Obama and his Justice Department that policing was shot through with systemic bias. And I don't agree with that, and I don't think that AG Sessions does either. I think what's been missing from the previous administration's analysis of policing is any acknowledgement that policing today is data-driven, and it goes to where people are most being victimized, and that is in minority neighborhoods. Mr. Chung is right to say that violent crime is rising significantly. In 2015, an additional 900 black males were killed than the previous year, and I expect 2016 to come in with a similar rise in crime. Where this is happening is predominantly in black neighborhoods, because that's where police officers are encountering the most hostility and have been told that they are racist for engaging in proactive policing. President Trump repeatedly called attention to the loss of black lives. AG Sessions did as well. And I find it a strange fact of our current political environment that when Donald Trump said that parents in inner city neighborhoods have the same right to expect that their children can walk to school without getting hit in a drive-by shooting, he was called a racist for doing so.
Back to Sari Horowitz with the Washington Post. Donald Trump has, in fact, said what we just heard. He's also indicated that he has some concern about the police. Where does he seem to stand, or does he take more than one position?
The president himself?
Yeah.
I mean, he has talked a lot about American carnage and the idea that the United States is sort of awash in violent crime. One particular policy that he did take an issue with during the campaign was the Obama policy, an initiative on clemency, where the Obama administration felt that the previous sentencing guidelines and the laws passed in the mid-1980s and the 1990s had gone too far, and he began letting certain drug offenders out of prison early and eventually let out about more than 1,700. And President Trump clearly spoke out against that policy, and I don't think you will see the Attorney General continuing that policy of clemency in federal prisons.
Ed Chung, back to you. What about the idea that some places, as you indicated, are in fact awash in crime? Are then black people principally the victims, as Donald Trump has said, as the Attorney General has said, and as Heather McDonald has said?
Well, I think certainly there are communities where in predominantly black neighborhoods there is there's crime, and there's higher rates of crime, and there's higher rates in violent crime. And again, let me just caveat, just to make sure that I'm being clear, these are in certain communities, and also in terms of the violent crime increases, those are also in certain communities and not nationally necessarily across the board. But in terms of how to address violent crime or crime increases, even this attorney general has shifted in what he said about crime rates and what they're going to do about it. Previously, or near the beginning of the administration, he spoke about this rising crime rate, and the clip that you played earlier was part of that. But in recent speeches, he's shifted that even a little bit, and he's talked about the fact and acknowledged, after being faced with the data, that crime rates continue, even if there were increases, to remain near historic lows. But the what they're justifying in terms of their policy, this tough on crime law and order policy, is now to make sure that this doesn't become a trend, or that it doesn't continue to increase long term. And from our perspective, it seems like a very ineffective and harmful and damaging way to try to prevent future crime by increasing incarceration and increasing the number of people who will come into contact with the criminal justice system.
That speech, the segment of the speech that we ran today was from this week, although, of course, we took it out of context. So he may well have shrouded it with the kinds of comments that you just suggested. Heather McDonald, back to you. What about the argument that, in fact, what's happened with police is that they have been racist? There is statistics, or there are statistics to support that. In some cases, perhaps the bad people in the barrel rather than a systemic issue. But doesn't it have to be dealt with?
Well, there have been bad shootings over the last 2.5 years, bad police shootings. And I completely acknowledge the history of racism and policing in this country, that police were essential in maintaining our grotesque betrayal of our founding ideals. They used brutal force to maintain slavery and de jure segregation, and that makes police shootings of blacks particularly and understandably fraught. Nevertheless, I don't know what statistics you're referring to, Warren, that you say support systemic police racism. In fact, a larger percentage of white and Hispanic homicide victims are killed by a cop than black homicide victims. 12% of all whites and Hispanics who die of homicide are killed by a police officer.
That's a very important point. Ed Chung, is she right, and I was wrong to say that there is support for the idea of significant bias on the behalf of police?
Well, I think the focus on homicides, it belies the fact that there are other types of policing actions that are that have a disproportionate impact on communities of color. And so let's just take the stop and frisk issue, where in widespread uses of stop and frisk, for example, in New York City or even in Baltimore, that's part of the recent consent decree that was entered into, the vast majority of people that were stopped were African-Americans or people of color. And in New York, close to 90% of those stops, which required reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, there was nothing to be found. There was nothing to be recovered. And the rates are even higher when it comes to Baltimore, where there was 96% over a five-year period where people, especially people of color, were stopped and nothing was recovered from them.
Obviously, a nuanced situation, very hard to generalize about this subject. We will continue the conversation, though, after we take a very brief break. On our talking point, we will be talking about a different subject, and I look forward to that. This is To the Point from PRI. Back to our conversation about the Sessions Attorney Generalship and the situation with regard to crime in the United States. Here again is a statement by the Attorney General before the International Association of Chiefs of Police.
Somebody from Washington can't declare how you're going to run policing in America.
And don't we know that proactive policing, broken windows, community-based policing has transformed our law enforcement capabilities? Why in the world would we want to impose a consent decree that undermines that? It makes no sense to me. And wherever that's really been done in a significant way, you've had problems like in, I won't mention it.
Adam Gelb directs the Pew Public Safety Performance Project, which helps states advance policies and practices in adult and juvenile sentencing and corrections that protect public safety, hold offenders accountable, and control corrections costs. Adam Gelb, good to have you on our program.
Great to be with you, Warren.
Where do you come down on this argument we're hearing, these two worldviews that we've heard about with regard to policing and incarceration?
Well, there are two worldviews indeed, Warren, and they're a little bit different from the ones you've been describing. The way we see it here at Pew is that there's the Washington world, and then there's the rest of the country. And in Washington, there's this sense, this bubble that you have that you can control somehow the way things work around the country, but the criminal justice system is a very state and local-based country, and what's going on in the states is very, very different from what you hear from the new attorney general. States over the past 10 years or so have been enacting comprehensive criminal justice reforms that really go in the other direction. States, starting with Texas in 2007, that state that is a very symbol of law and order in this country, are saying we got enough people locked up, and we now have the research that shows us there are more effective and less expensive ways to combat crime. And so we're going to focus our prison cells on the people who are truly dangerous and try to do a better job breaking that cycle of recidivism for these lower-level offenders.
What is done as an alternative to jail and prison?
There is a wide array of alternatives, and they range from drug courts, where people, particularly those with drug problems, are put in a carrot and stick approach that says if you stay clean and you go to treatment and you report like you're supposed to report, then you can stay out on the street. If you're not, you are going to get increasing swift and certain sanctions, maybe 2 days in jail, maybe electronic monitoring. But we're going to work with you and acknowledge that addiction is a chronic relapsing disorder, and not just jam you back in a $30,000 a year taxpayer-funded prison cell as a first resort.
So we're talking about drug offenders in this case. Are there reforms that reach other kinds of offenders as well?
Sure. There's a giant system in this country called community supervision, and the bulk of it is straight probation and a combination of things that research really now shows it works. You know, Warren, when we started out on this prison building path about 40 years ago now, we didn't know much about what worked to stop this revolving door, and now we do. And it starts with risk assessment instruments that identify specifically what offenders' particular risks are and what needs are, how intensively they should be supervised, and what particular kind of program works for them to try to change their behavior. Then we know that we need to respond with these swift and certain sanctions and rewards, importantly, when somebody is doing well and they're staying clean and reporting like they're doing and they're not getting arrested. They need to get positive reinforcement for that. And then most importantly, at the end of this, we have changes to the system itself, which has basically been feeding on itself by sending back so many violators of supervision to prison, and mostly doing so because it's the easy thing to do. You can avoid the political risk of somebody on your caseload doing something wrong by sending somebody back to state prison, and you don't bear the cost for that if you're a local supervision system. So by aligning those incentives and saying, hey, you can throw people in prison if you want, but you're going to have to pay for that, just that simple alignment of the financial dynamics here is causing pretty significant reductions in returns to prison.
Adam Gelb, again, with the Pew Foundation. Let me go back to Sari Horowitz with the Washington Post. Very early in the program, we talked about Steve Cook, who has now joined the Justice Department, somebody regarded as a serious warrior in the so-called war on drugs. He has said that all drug offenses are, in fact, violent. What do you think he means by that?
Well, he has said that there's no such thing as a low-level, non-violent drug offender, which is the term that was used in the Obama administration for the people he wanted to let out who he felt the sentences were too long. What Steve Cook says is that drug dealing is inherently violent, that the fighting over turf, that the money involved in the business, that it all is tied around violence, and that you're not letting out anyone that hasn't been isn't violent in some way. On the other hand, I wrote a long series about prisons and prison reform and visited a lot of prisons. And I wrote about people who were in prison, in one particular case, a woman named Sharonda Jones in Texas. And she was a low-level drug offender who was not involved in any violence. And you can go through her records, no violence. But she was sentenced to life without parole for her first drug offense because of the mandatory minimum drug laws. So there are many cases across the country. That was one of many where there are people who are low-level drug offenders who are not necessarily tied into violence. But Steve Cook does believe there is no such thing as a nonviolent drug offender.
Adam Gelb, would that still be possible, life without parole in Texas? You said there had been reforms there, a case just described where the woman had not been violent, but because of the mandatory minimum, she had to get life for her first offense.
I can't say specifically about that case, Warren, but the bigger picture here is that Texas, South Carolina, Mississippi, Georgia, Utah, South Dakota, states all across this country, and states really primarily led by Republican governors and with strong public support in these states, have now passed this wave of reforms that does say we want prisons for people we are truly afraid of. We want to divert those people we are merely mad at. And the results have been really quite astounding. You know, the incarceration rate in this country peaked in about 2007, 2008, and it has dropped by 13% since then. The crime rate has dropped by 24% since then. And so we find ourselves in this period of time now where you can reduce both incarceration and crime at the same time. We have so many people locked up. We have enough space. And it's a question of making sure we get the right people in that space. And that's exactly what states are doing.
Heather McDonald, back to you at the Manhattan Institute. Once again, author of Are Cops Racist? How the War Against the Police Harms Black Americans. Now we're talking not about federal consent decrees, but rather about what's going on at the states and the reforms that Adam Gelb describes there. Do you agree that they've had a positive effect?
Well, I think we also are talking about the federal drug penalties. I think that's what the Washington Post reporter was talking about, and Steve Cook and mandatory minimums.
True.
I certainly agree with the swift and certain sanctioning that Mr. Gelb was talking about. I'm not sure how well that works, however, for property and violence offenders. Prison is not an end in itself, and if we could really determine alternatives to incarceration that have the same public safety benefits, that would be wonderful. But the Justice Department evaluates reentry and rehabilitation programs and finds very few that actually meet the standard for a random controlled experiment that have any effect. The JFA Institute has estimated that only 3% of all violent and property offenders actually end up in prison. The idea that we are draconian, hauling people away for minor offenses is simply wrong. You have to work hard to get yourself sentenced to prison, which remains pretty much a lifetime achievement award for persistence in criminal offending. But, you know, certainly I'm not against reconsidering the federal mandatory minimum penalties because all penalties are arbitrary. But the idea that Cook has put forward and Sessions would agree with, that there is an inherent violence in outdoor drug trafficking thing, I think is correct. You cannot go to a meeting of a police community meeting in a high crime area where you will not hear people begging for the dealers to get off the streets. The most frequent complaint is you arrest them and they're back there the next day. People who live under the pall of open-air drug dealing understand that it is backed up with the implicit threat of violence.
Well, let me go back to Ed Chung again, formerly with the Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department during the Obama administration and now at the Center for American Progress. What do you say to that?
So a couple things I think we have to break out of here. What I agree that all penalties are arbitrary. And so when we're talking about reconsideration of mandatory minimums, we're talking about things that were arbitrarily put in place in the 80s and 90s, and that with the same type of theory or mentality that Mr. Cook puts out, that every single thing connected to drug trafficking or every single situation or every single incident connected to drug trafficking or the drug trafficking trade is inherently violent. And so what we have seen over the past course of the past 30 years is that our punishment arbitrarily has increased because of that type of worldview. What Adam is talking about is that basically, in recent past, in the last 10 years or so, states, left, right, red, blue, are reconsidering those perceived notions and really looking at the data to see what works. I do have a little bit of disagreement with what Ms. McDonald said about whether or not the Justice Department is looking at the effectiveness of reentry policies, the effectiveness of criminal justice policies. I think over the course of the past 8 years, especially if not longer, the Justice Department has been working hand in hand with state and locals of all political, led by all political parties, regardless of the political party, to make these advancements. And what we have seen is the tremendous progress that Adam has mentioned in states and localities across the country.
Ed Chung, once again, at the Center for American Progress, where he's Vice President for Criminal Justice Reform, formerly with the Civil Rights Department, Division of the Department of Justice. Thanks so much for being on our program.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Okay. Very quickly, Adam Gelb, what about this? And you mentioned earlier states such as Texas, for example, Mississippi, and others that are engaged in a police reform. Is it partly because incarceration is a lot more expensive than the alternatives?
It is. There's no question that money and budgets are part of this. But I have to say, Warren, as well, we have been out on the ground working with governors and legislative leaders from both parties in all these states. That's the beginning of the conversation. That's not the end. States like Texas and South Carolina are not doing what they're doing because they're trying to save a buck and balance their budgets on the back of public safety. That is just not what we're seeing. What we're seeing is a greater recognition, again, on both sides of the aisle, that prison is probably the most expensive and least effective way to control crime, that we have much better ways to prevent crime before it happens and to steer offender behavior back in the right direction, and that's a much better path to pursue than to just wait until crimes are committed and try to lock up as many people for as long as possible. In fact, most law enforcement officers and most line prosecutors in the community are on board with this at this point. Victims of crime significantly recognize at this stage that we're not going to build our way out of this problem. We tried to do that. We expanded the prison population by four or five times from its historical rates. And we did get some crime control benefit out of it, but we're at the point now where with nearly one in 100 adults behind bars, we've got to do a better job figuring out who really needs to be there and different strategies to make our community safe.
So, Heather McDonald, given that conservative states seem to have similar views to the blue states, is there a discrepancy between them and other Republicans, such as the Attorney General? Is there a disagreement on the conservative side of the aisle?
No, I don't think so. And I would like to respond to Mr. Gelb saying that better prison is sort of waiting until a crime is committed and then sort of just reacting to that. The best way to prevent crimes from being committed, short of, say, rebuilding the family, is precisely the type of proactive policing that Jeff Sessions mentioned in one of the quotes you played, which is to intervene early in suspicious behavior and to respond to those low-level quality of life complaints that is what people in high-crime neighborhoods most frequently complain about. The kids hanging out on the corners, the fighting, the disorderly conduct, precisely the sort of behavior that the Baltimore consent decree that Jeff Sessions rightly wanted to reconsider now penalizes the cops for doing. I think the voice that needs to be heard in this conversation most frequently is the residents of high crime areas and their fervent desire for police to intervene in public disorder.
So, Sari Horowitz, back to you. Final question, again, covering the Justice Department for The Washington Post. What's happening in Congress in this regard? There was some talk for quite a long time about police reform. There were a lot of conservatives on board, including, as I earlier indicated earlier, the Koch brothers, Chuck Grassley of Iowa, and Mike Lee of Utah, and they were on board with the NAACP at one point. Senator, when he was a senator, Attorney General Sessions helped to kill that bill. Is it dead forever?
Well, that's a very good question. That was moving forward, the sentencing reform bill, and it never made it to the floor, although it got out of committee. Jeff Sessions voted against it. There has been some talk recently. Someone from the Trump administration went to the Hill and was talking to people about possibly reviving a sentencing reform bill. So we may see something in the future on the Hill. But what I know for sure that we're going to see from the Justice Department is that the Attorney General is preparing a plan now to prosecute more drug cases, more gun cases, and pursue more mandatory minimum sentences. Also going to take a harder line on punishing the use and distribution of marijuana. And the Justice Department is again going to use private prisons to house federal inmates, something that had been reversed in the Obama administration. So I think we're going to see a lot more movement out of the Justice Department on these issues.
And very quickly, we haven't had time to talk at all about states that have legalized not just medical marijuana, but also recreational marijuana. What are they? How's it looking for them?
Are you asking me?
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. 8 states and the District of Columbia permit the recreational use of marijuana, and 28 states and D.C. have legalized the use of medical marijuana.
Still, a class one drug as illegal as heroin and cocaine under federal law.
Exactly. It is illegal under federal law to use or distribute marijuana. And of course, that is a conflict with those states. It is unclear what the Attorney General is going to do about that. The Obama administration sort of looked the other way. And we know that the Attorney General Sessions abhors the use of marijuana.
All right. We'll see what happens next. Sari Horowitz, Ed Chung, Heather McDonald, Adam Gelb, thank you all very much for being on our program today. Tuition assistance for New York students makes college free, but not for everybody. We'll talk about that in a moment on To the Point. Warren Olney here with today's Talking Point. In January, New York Governor Andrew Cuomo promised to make good on a bipartisan objective: free college tuition for every qualified student. Today, he signed a bill into law with the support of Hillary Clinton.
You know, what we need to be doing is throwing open the doors for everybody willing to work and achieve their education. Now, Andrew Cuomo understood that, and I am so proud that he has produced this. And look, I hope it's the first of many states.
Let's take a look at today's legislation, the benefits and the limitations. Will Doyle is Associate Professor of Higher Education at Vanderbilt University. He's a specialist in education costs related to family income around the country. Good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Is this bill being oversold?
Well, this bill does provide free college, but it's for a particular group of students. So what the bill does is for students who are enrolling in college for the first time and are enrolling full time, so that's 30 credits a year, 15 credits each semester, it's going to make sure that they don't have to pay tuition. But the way it's going to do that is actually by being what's called a last dollar in. So first comes the federal money in the form of a Pell Grant, then comes additional state or maybe institutional money, and the state will provide the last dollar. So when you look at that, for a lot of low-income students, they're already receiving an amount of financial aid that's pretty close to what the tuition is. So it's going to, and then the amount of this will go to students who make up to about $110,000. or whose families make that. So it's going to cover a group of students who haven't gotten much or haven't gotten as much financial aid in the past, but it's not necessarily going to make it free for everybody, particularly those who don't go full time or who don't qualify for the other provisions in the program.
How many students of the nature we're talking about, people who can't afford the tuition, can't go full time because they have to work?
So when students can't afford to pay the price of college, they're faced with a kind of a bad set of options. They have to reduce the number of credits they take because that will make it more affordable. You can pay a little less that way. And they also have to work more. And so when you're faced with trying to pay all of the costs of college, which do go beyond tuition, lots of times one of the things you have to do is attend fewer classes and work more. And unfortunately, those students won't be eligible for this program.
How did that happen? Did that get amended into the bill at the last minute?
I don't know the process. I know that the intention was to kind of reward on-time graduation, kind of students making progress towards their degree. But that can be very difficult, particularly for students who are trying to pay these other associated costs.
And those include housing and food.
Yeah, people have to pay to live while they go in college. And these aren't trivial costs. So right now, for a student who's going to a two-year college in New York, once you take into account all of the tuition and financial aid and you take out all the grant aid that's available to them, they still have to pay about a third of their family income in order to be able to attend full time.
So what age of student are we talking about? You mentioned family income. Are these people who already have families, are they adults?
So you could have – it's first-time students, but it could be students who are either living with their families or have families of their own. So, yeah, the life situations of college students are considerably more complex now than they were in the past, trying to figure out things like transportation, childcare, an additional set of costs that go beyond just tuition, and it can be really important. For instance, in the City University of New York, and they had a program called ASAP, which helps students get both curricular assistance and other assistance to get them on track for on-time graduation. One of the most important things that program did for them was provide them with a Metro card for transportation.
It's my understanding there also was a clause put into the New York law that requires people to stay in the state of New York for the same length of time that they get the assistance. What's that about?
So this is relatively unusual for financial aid programs. So, and I understand the kind of impulse here, and it's like it's reciprocity. They're trying to get students to give back something for what they receive from the state. But there's other ways to do that. You can ask students to do community service or contribute to their communities in other ways. But, you know, the governor's intention, as he stated it, was they, you know, people got this from the state. We've invested in you. And so you should stay in the state and, you know, provide taxes and other things that'll be good for the state. The issue here is that college increases opportunity, and that's what we want it to do. We want people to have more opportunities than they had in the past, and one of those opportunities is more geographic mobility. We know that college students are more geographically mobile. This isn't a huge issue for New York. Most of the students were going to stay in the state anyway. So I'm not sure exactly whether the costs of implementing this are going to be worth all of the trade-offs that the state's getting into.
Let's talk about, in a more general term about now, or in more general terms, about not just New York, but other states as well, and the affordability of college. New York may be different from a lot of other places. How important or how expensive has college become for people who don't necessarily live in high-cost states like New York or California?
Well, it's gotten expensive across the board. What we've seen over time is that the cost of running a college keeps on getting more expensive. And states either can't or won't keep up with those increasing costs. And what's happened is that students and families have been left holding the bag. So we've seen this gradual shift over time to where students are, and the families are being asked to pay more and more of the cost of higher education. Interestingly, it's not the cost of living in the state that drives how much students and families pay. It's state policy. So California is a high-cost state in terms of where, you know, as a place to live, but it's actually quite affordable. When we did a ranking of all 50 states on their level of college affordability, California was fourth, and they got there by just plain old low tuition plus need-based financial aid. New York, by contrast, is 39th.
So need-based would mean that they also get help for rent and food and housing and the kinds of things that are additional to tuition.
Yeah, the right way to define college affordability is kind of what you're actually going to have to pay to make this happen. So that's going to include tuition. It's going to include fees. And then it's also going to include the cost of books and other educational requirements and the cost to live during the time that you're enrolled. And take out all the financial aid that's provided to people. And so most broad financial aid programs do include a component that's about just how much it costs to live while you're attending classes.
What are the most affordable and least affordable states?
So some of the most affordable states are relatively small states that have pretty good family income. You know, the families are doing all right, and they've kept the cost of college down. So that's states like Alaska, Wyoming, and Hawaii. And then the most notable one in that range is California. So that's not a small state, but the state policymakers there have really committed to keeping the price of higher education low, particularly at community colleges, and providing substantial financial aid.
Least affordable, I understand, is New Hampshire?
It is. And what's going on there is very high tuition. Tuition at public colleges, it's pretty similar to tuition at private colleges. And the state providing little and basically no financial aid to students.
All right. Obviously an issue that is going to be with us for a long time. We'll see what happens in New York and whether it will spread to other states as well in the same or different forms. Will Doyle, Associate Professor of Public Policy, Higher Education, Vanderbilt University. Thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Orman Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.